Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Tonight, our guest is Lara Bazelon, law professor and director of the Criminal, Juvenile, and Racial Justice Clinics at the University of San Francisco School of Law. In addition to practicing and teaching law, she's also the author of the book Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. The data on wrongful conviction in the United States is grim. On any given day, over 15,000 innocent people are in prison in the United States, and an estimated 4.1% of prisoners on death row are in fact innocent. Shockingly, the average time an innocent person can spend behind bars is 9 years, 3 months, though the majority of such prisoners spend decades in prisons and eventually die there. The trauma caused by these failings of our justice system is often catastrophic, and those harms extend not only to the wrongfully convicted, but to their families and to the victims of the underlying crimes, jury members, and all those who have inadvertently and unwittingly participated in the process that led to the wrongful conviction. In addition to her legal work, Ms. Bazelon has written on a variety of subjects for Slate, The New York Times, Politico, and The Atlantic Monthly, among other publications. Her incisive op-ed pieces range from her support for Betsy DeVos's Title IX reforms to why Christine Blasey Ford's memory is more credible than Justice Kavanaugh's. Lara's most recent op-ed for The New York Times is entitled, I've Picked My Job Over My Kids, which, not surprisingly, triggered an explosion of comments. Her perspectives are always thoughtful, nuanced, and a challenge for you to think more deeply. So welcome, Lara.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. And in 20 minutes, we will invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. Send your questions and comments for Lara at any time by emailing us at cityvisions@kalw.org. So it's such a pleasure to have you tonight. I enjoyed your book, Rectify. And I know a lot of your work is focused on wrongful convictions and innocence project-related cases. But I wanted to start with your recent op-ed in The New York Times about which, as I noted, was entitled, I've Picked My Job Over My Kids. And that was ran in June. It was an op-ed that talked about how you have been, quote unquote, trying to do the work-life balance and how sometimes work kind of takes precedence over the children. And could you describe it a little bit more?
Yeah, so it's interesting because it does intersect with my wrongful convictions work in that what prompted me to think about it was my experience defending someone who had been wrongfully convicted and how intense that experience was and how much time it took away from my children to try that case and involving me moving to a different city and spending long periods of time away from them. So it was in the context of how important that work is, but also realizing that women are kind of held to an impossible standard where we're being told that there is such a thing as a work-life balance. And I really wanted to challenge that because I don't think that things are perfectly in equipoise. I think it's more that the scale is sliding really dramatically from one end to the other. And there will be times when you have a lot of time as a mother to spend with your children, and there will be times when you have very scant time. And that you shouldn't be made to feel ashamed and guilty, but women are, because the expectations for us to sort of perform perfectly in both realms are so high.
And it was an op-ed piece that I think received over 1,300 comments. And I'd love for you to read a section of it. I think it's the part where you are appearing at your son's school, and they're talking about your son is giving a presentation about your work and his feelings about his parents. Could you read that for us?
Sure. So this happened a couple of Thanksgivings ago, and it was a midday Thanksgiving potluck. And the children were given an orange cutout leaf, and they were told to put on the leaf something about their parents. I appreciate my parents because this helps me too. And so I was sitting with the other parents, mostly moms, waiting to see what my son was going to say about me. So I'll just start reading. One by one, the children stood up and read what they had written. Many of them talked about how much they loved their moms because they made them delicious food or gave them a safe place to live. I grew uncomfortable as I listened, my smile frozen on my face. What on earth was my son going to say when it was his turn? That he lived in two different houses and routinely ate boiled hot dogs and chicken fingers while his mom told true crime stories? That he had once told me politely as we sat down to dinner, Mom, I think you forgot the vegetable. My son was one of the last children to speak. He stood up and in a clear voice said, I appreciate my parents for being lawyers because they get people out of jail. This helps me reflect, do the right thing, and have positive role models. He looked over at me, the barest hint of a smile on his face. I wanted to leap out of my pint-sized chair, raise my fist in the air, and yell, "That's my boy." I have his orange leaf on the wall in my office. Sometimes I look over at it when I'm working late at night. I hope my kids get it. I think they do. I love them beyond all reason, and their existence gives my life profound meaning. And I have the same feelings about my job.
That's so beautiful. And were you surprised by the commentary that you received for the article?
What surprised me was that there weren't more negative reactions, particularly in the directed commentary that came to me through, I would say, probably hundreds of emails and social media postings. And I was braced for the worst. And compared to some of the other responses I've received from other things that I've written, so you referred to what I wrote about Title IX and Betsy DeVos, compared to that, it was fairly muted. I think the negative comments were things like, "Gee, I hope you don't expect your kids to visit you when you're in a nursing home and you're going to die alone." A lot of the comments I got, though, were from women who basically said, "This is my story, and I just have always felt embarrassed and ashamed to say it," which is so often the case. Sometimes when you just write from a place of vulnerability, I found there's a strength in that, and there is this silent chorus of people who are singing along with you.
I was struck by a comment from a reader who had said, "If you'd replace the word mother with father, this probably wouldn't even be an op-ed in the New York Times." What do you think about that?
I think that's absolutely right. Good Morning America did a segment, and the parenting expert said, "If her name had been Larry instead of Lara, we wouldn't be here." Because we don't question these decisions when men make them. I mean, I'll just give you an example from my own life. When I was growing up, my dad, who was a very hard-charging trial lawyer, actually still is, had a case in Florida. We lived in Pennsylvania. And for 8 years, 1 week out of every month, he was gone litigating this case. And it was just sort of accepted in our family fabric that that was going to happen. My mom was a full-time physician. She had gone to medical school and worked. But the idea that she would be gone 1 week out of every month for 2 months, much less 8 years, was unthinkable. And so we make these assumptions about what's acceptable for fathers and what's acceptable for mothers. And those assumptions and stereotypes carry over to this day.
And given how you were raised and seeing your father as a trial lawyer, did this feel kind of a natural thing to do and to take time off to be with your client, who obviously was in very desperate need for legal representation? Did that come naturally to you, or was that a struggle?
I think it was very much an ingrained lesson that my sisters and I, were really brought up to believe that we had been given a lot and we should give back. And also, we saw firsthand how seriously our parents took their work. So my dad took his work to heart, and his clients would call, and he would take those calls at dinner. There were vacations where he was in the phone booth, where they still had phone booths, talking to various people trying to litigate. And it was the same with my mom. She had patients who needed her, and she would check from her answering service to see if she had messages and be in touch with people who had a lot of needs. And so we kind of grew up understanding that our parents loved us, and our health and safety was important. And so was the health and safety of the people that they had promised that they would help. And so I think in some ways it was kind of a natural response for me when Cash's case came to me, and I realized that if I didn't really try this case, retry it perfectly, he was going to die in prison and he was innocent. When I realized that, and it kind of fully hit me, there was no question in my mind that he needed me more and I was going to do whatever I could to get him out. And when my kids and I would talk about it, I would say, "Cash needs to go home because his mom is waiting for him. And he needs to see his mom." And his mom, Wilma, had waited 34 years for him to come home. And I wanted to make sure that she got to see him.
Well, I definitely want to get into that story. But just one last tangent, which is you seem to be very good at explaining difficult and complicated things to your children. And I think another great op-ed of yours was how you would tell the stories of Game of Thrones, the HBO series, to your kids in order to keep them entranced and engaged, particularly even when you're out or in the car. Tell us a little bit about that.
So I am a divorced single parent, and as many divorced single parents know, when it's two-on-one, there's just no chance for you. And so when I am at meals with my kids, it's really just about self-preservation, stopping sibling-on-sibling violence, and making sure that some food gets eaten. And that was especially true when they were younger. And I would just struggle and struggle, and my kids didn't want to eat what I had made, and they would get up in the middle and get into these battles with swords and shields. And I realized they were basically pint-sized Game of Thrones actors. And at the same time, I was listening to the book in my car, and I realized there was a PG-ish, 13-ish version maybe that I could tell them that would be engaging, because they kept asking me questions about the people with the funny voices when I would turn off the recording and they got in the car. So I just started telling them edited versions of the episodes, and they loved it. And I just realized that this was kind of this perfect magic trick that was going to keep them in their seats and keep them engaged, especially when we were out in public, and make sure that, yeah, they ate their food.
I think there are a lot of parents who could use your abridged version of that series for help in the restaurants. Well, you had spoken about Cash, Register Your Client, and I thought that let's talk a little bit about him and your work in wrongful convictions or overturning wrongful convictions. Can you tell us how you got into the work and a little bit about Cash's case?
So my background is actually in public defense, and so innocence really isn't the issue when you're a public defender. I was a federal public defender. You take everybody, and you're not selective. Innocence work is really different. You're highly, highly selective, and you're only selecting people who you think are truly innocent and that you can prove are truly innocent. So Cash fell into this really unique category, and his case was one that was marked by all kinds of misconduct and also just real racism. He was an African-American 18-year-old, and he was picked up for the robbery and murder of an elderly white man. And the only evidence against him were the testimonies of two eyewitnesses. And it was pretty clear that they had both been promised things in exchange for their testimony, that they had things to hide, and none of that information was turned over to Cash's lawyers. It's also pretty clear to me that this jury, which was all white, probably wouldn't have convicted him if he had been white. But they looked at him, I think, and they saw somebody disposable. And they felt, well, it's probably close enough. And I have that sense not just from reading the record and my experience with these cases, but also because I talked to one of the jurors decades later about what had happened in the jury room. And so there were so many things about it that were truly troubling. And then the big issue was, could we prove it after all these years?
Right. And you were able to do so.
We were. And it was a really long struggle. And that struggle actually got me really interested in restorative justice and thinking how much everyone involved in that process could have benefited from it, but we didn't have it available to us.
Well, let's go into what is restorative justice? That's part of the title of your book. And for the listeners who may have never heard of the term, what is it?
Restorative justice stands really outside the criminal system and is kind of opposite of it in certain ways. So it's not focused on blame and punishment and consequences that are super severe, these long prison sentences that we mete out. It asks who was harmed, what are that person's needs, and whose obligation is it to meet those needs. It's focused on victims' needs, their needs to be validated, to tell their stories under their own terms and under their own power, to have acknowledgement of their suffering by the offender, to have some kind of reckoning where the offender has to grapple with what he or she has done and the harm that they have inflicted. And then the parties together, and often with friends and community members, form a circle and they determine what kind of redress is going to happen moving forward to hold that person accountable. So it's quite different than the criminal system, particularly for victims, because in the criminal justice system, victims are really passive supporting players. Their name is even taken away. One of the people I talked to in my book told me of this cousin of hers who had been raped and murdered, that Debbie had been erased. Even her name was taken away. And because she was a rape victim, her body was evidence. She basically was just completely divorced from the process. And the way that prosecutors interact with victims is, we need you to testify in this certain way. We need you to do this certain thing. And then, of course, they have to undergo cross-examination, which is very traumatic. Restorative justice really restores the power to them and allows them to confront the person who has harmed them, explain what happened, interact with that person in a way that is controlled and mediated by people who are professional, and come to a result that is much more focused on their healing than it is on retribution. So it seems counterintuitive because as a society, we're very focused on how much we can punish people, how much time we can give them, how much we can condemn them. But what the studies show is that none of that has any effect on victim healing, and that quite often some of these cases are unprovable or in some cases defective for all the reasons that happened in Cash's case. So talk about not having any kind of atonement or healing. Imagine what that robbery victim's family felt after all these years, having been told this lie that the person who had taken their father away had been found and convicted, when in fact they didn't look for the right person and will never find that person.
And it seems your book really explains how in wrongful convictions, there's not just the harm done to the person who's been in prison, the innocent person in prison wrongfully. There's a lot of collateral damage, the initial victim of the crime, the families of everybody involved, the jury members, prosecutors, sometimes police, you know, who have all participated in a process that didn't necessarily come out with the right solution, i.e., getting the culprit in jail. So we hear so much about criminal justice, and it's a very favorite topic on national broadcast shows. And, you know, you watch a Law and Order or a CSI and you think science is great, but the wrong people get into jail. Justice is always served. But reading your book, it's clear that's not the case. Can you tell us a little bit about the statistics on wrongful conviction? How many people in the United States are wrongfully incarcerated?
It's pretty disturbing. So there is an empirical study that was done by the University of Michigan about people who are on death row. And that study found that 4.1% of people on death row sentenced to die are, in fact, innocent. Then there are estimates from the non-death row population, and they range anywhere from, say, 2 to 10%. But if you take the kind of conservative middle and you look at the total number of people who are incarcerated, it's enough people to fill a football stadium. It's about 65,000 people. So it's pretty shocking. And that's just the ones that we can predict. There are the less serious cases, these misdemeanors that no one will ever really investigate because people aren't in prison anymore. And yet the studies show that pretrial detention, the fact that you can't get out unless you plead guilty, causes innocent people to plead guilty over and over. And so we're not even accounting for that population, which is a population that the wrongful conviction movement can't even reach for lack of resources.
And what are the reasons for wrongful conviction?
There are a number. So one big reason is misconduct by prosecutors and police, and that is a broad range of things. They can coerce victims to lie or shade their testimony. They cannot comply with their obligations under the Constitution and not turn over information that tends to show that one of their witnesses is being untruthful or that the person they're accusing is actually innocent. People falsely confess, and I think the Central Park Five and the new docuseries, When They See Us, really drive home this point because it's sort of unfathomable that you would confess to this horrible thing that you didn't do, and yet people do that. In 13% of wrongful conviction cases, there's a false confession. Often that's because the police, again, are very coercive. The suspects are juveniles or they're intellectually disabled. Oftentimes what you hear over and over again is, I just signed it or I just said it so that I could go home. Brendan Dassey believed that in Making a Murderer. So I think we're learning more and more that this actually happens, even though it seems very counterintuitive. And then there is this junk science where jurors are told, this is an absolute match. This hair that was found at the crime scene is a match to the hair on the victim's head. In 2015, we learned that that science isn't science at all. It's actually completely bogus. And so what jurors had been told was not true. And that's evidence that comes up in a lot of these wrongful conviction cases where jurors might be unsure, but they think, oh, but that forensic evidence that that expert told me about, that's really damning. And in so many cases, including hair and bite marks, which again is a science that has been totally debunked and yet is still being used in some states, jurors are being fed this information confirmed by what they see on, say, Law and Order or CSI,
right?
And they think, oh, okay, I'm a little bit unsure based on the testimony, but now I'm convinced.
Mm-hmm. And the idea that, as you were talking about, the TV shows that make it seem like science is science, and, you know, if you see a hair on this person, that must be great evidence. Is there any scientific evidence that is sort of irrefutable? Is it just DNA?
DNA really is the gold standard. And then fingerprint evidence is generally very reliable, but there is some variability because different states in the federal government have different standards for what is a match. So there's a 6-point match or a 10-point match or a 12-point match. The more points you have of matching on a fingerprint, the more likely it is to be accurate. And then, of course, you also have partial fingerprints and smudged fingerprints. So if you have a pristine fingerprint and a high number of matching points, that's pretty close to DNA in terms of accuracy. But of course, that's not most fingerprints. Another cause I should mention, because it's so crucial for people to understand, is mistaken identification, right? And that's when the witness truly believes that they have identified the correct person. And that happened over and over again in cases that I looked at in my book. And because of so many things, the trauma, the quickness with which an incident can happen, but most profoundly when there's a cross-racial issue and the perpetrator and the victim are different races, there can be a mistaken good faith identification.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, I'm talking with Lara Bazelon, author of the book Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. And she's also a frequent contributor to Slate, The New York Times, Politico, and The Atlantic Monthly. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments about wrongful convictions or your work-life balance as well. Do you have questions for Lara about her book, Rectify? Give us a call. Join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can find us finally at cityvisionskalw on Twitter. So before we took a break, we were talking about misidentifications, and I've actually done one of these where I was mugged, and I needed to make a lineup, like identify the person in a photo array. And I went to law school, and I thought, oh, this is exactly what we studied. I couldn't do it. I had a really hard time. I actually never identified anybody, and I didn't learn then how often there was misidentification. But experiencing it, I could see how that could very much happen. So can you talk a little bit about what we see, again, on TV, just lineups that people see where you look at somebody from behind a two-way mirror or photo arrays? Why do those work and why do they not work?
That's a great question. That's a really profound experience. It sounds like you were extremely careful and deliberative. So the way that they're supposed to work is that you're supposed to be behind glass where the other person can't see you. You're supposed to have an array of five or six people that all look, generally speaking, pretty much alike. That's for a lineup. And then for photo arrays, you're supposed to, best practices to show the picture sequentially rather than all at the same time so that you don't end up doing this sort of process of elimination where you pick the person who looks the most like the person who attacked or violated you. So there are best practices, and then there's the way that things happen in the real world. So I'll give you an example. My students and I in the Racial Justice Clinic are working on a case right now where our client was picked up 18 hours after a robbery occurred. So the robbery occurred very early in the morning, 2:15 in the morning. It was a Caucasian man who was robbed of $102. There was a gun, but no one was hurt. The gun wasn't fired. It happened very quickly. It was kind of dark. He called 911 and he said, these two African-American men robbed me. One of them had a gray sweatshirt on. And 18 hours later, our client was picked up because he was a young man in a gray sweatshirt. And when the police tried to get him to stop, he ran. They chased him. He threw a gun away. They pick up the gun and they arrest him for that. But they're on proactive patrol looking for this guy, looking for this robber or one of the robbers. And so what do? Do they do a six pack? Do they do a lineup? No. They call the victim and they say, we have a suspect in custody. Can you come down and make an identification? So the victim is placed in a patrol car. He's afraid. And he says, I don't want to get too close. And they say, don't worry, you can sit in this car 20 feet away. We'll shine the spotlight on him. And they shine the spotlight on our client in handcuffs with an officer on either side of him, clearly arrested. And there's no one else there, wearing a gray hoodie. And the guy says, that's him. And at trial, that was essentially the evidence. And in addition, the guy saying, essentially, that could be the same gun, even though it's a very, very common make and model. The money that was found didn't match in terms of denomination, and there was no other evidence. And he was convicted and sentenced to 60 years in prison. He was 19 years old.
60 years.
60, 6-0. And it sort of harkened back to an experience I had this spring when I was teaching criminal procedure to my students, and we got to this whole doctrine of eyewitness identification, and I was teaching it to them. And the truth is, what I just described to you is perfectly legal. And as I taught them this doctrine, the case is called Manson versus Brathwaite. It's from the 1960s, and it's never been overruled, saying, yes, we don't condone this, and this is unduly suggestive, and this is a problem, but you can overcome it, judge, and allow it in through various means. And that's what happened in this case. It was challenged and he was still allowed to make this identification. And what I said to my students is, I have to teach you this law because it's the law and because it's going to be on the bar and you're going to be tested on it. But I will tell you this, the law is trash. And I say that because my clients have been wrongfully convicted based on exactly these kind of suggestive procedures.
And for your client right now, are you challenging his conviction or working on it?
We are.
And is it based on that identification that you're challenging it, or?
It is based on that identification. It's based on a number of things. His defense, if that's what you want to call it, consisted of a 3-minute opening statement, a 6-minute closing argument, no defense, even though he had a defense. They didn't investigate or put on his witnesses to give his defense. So the representation that he got was pretty abysmal. He was tried and convicted in less than one day. And when we talked to the Innocence Project in Louisiana, where this case was tried, they told us that all of their exonerations, I think it's somewhere between 17 and 18, have involved young black men who were tried and convicted in less than a day.
Wow. And I think one of the other reasons there are wrongful convictions that you talked about in your book is just not great representation, right?
That is a huge problem. And it comes from a number of different sources, including people who are public defenders, maybe not being well-resourced, being completely overwhelmed. There are public defender's offices like in Alameda County and here in San Francisco that are excellent. They're very well-resourced. But then you get to a place, say, like New Orleans, and they're so overwhelmed that for a while they weren't actually taking any cases to protest how overwhelmed they were.
And public defense, we think about everybody gets some kind of lawyer or is entitled to a public defender, but some jurisdictions, some states don't even pay for public defenders. Is that right? Or...
That is sad but true. There are states with no public defender system at all. And so then what ends up happening essentially is that the cases go to the lowest bidder. And so they give it to the attorney who's willing to work for the least amount of money and take the most cases. And you get what you pay for.
Well, your book also talks about units are, we know that they're wrongful convictions and you have the empirical evidence that it happens. And there are some jurisdictions that have put together task forces or offices to kind of look into that. And that seems like a best practice. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. They're called wrongful conviction units or post-conviction integrity units. And there's some very, very successful models, including one in Brooklyn. There's one in Philadelphia under the new DA, Larry Krasner, that's been doing some really exciting work. And basically the idea behind them is that prosecutors keep an open mind. When a defense attorney or an innocence advocate comes to them with a credible claim of wrongful conviction, such as we had in Cash's case, rather than telling that person to get lost, which is what the LADA told us to do, they accept the idea that something could have gone wrong. And they approach it with an open mind. They agree to some kind of a joint investigation, or they allow the defense investigation to go forward and new evidence to be presented. And if they are convinced that the conviction was wrongful, they join with the defense in asking for that conviction to be overturned. And almost always the judge will agree to do that because it's a rare instance in court of both sides actually wanting the same thing.
Well, let's go to an email here. We have an email from Mark. Can you comment on Kamala Harris's record, particularly on Prop 47 regarding reduced sentences? And you, just as background, you had written an article, an op-ed about Kamala Harris's record as whether or not she was a progressive attorney general or not.
Right. So I wrote that op-ed in response to a book that Kamala Harris wrote called The Truths We Hold, where she described herself as a progressive prosecutor. And she talked specifically about how she knew what it was like for people of color and people who are poor to be wrongfully accused and also over-sentenced and just disproportionately affected by the criminal justice system. And when I read it, I was very surprised that she was using that term progressive prosecutor about herself, getting back to Mark's question, because on almost every issue, there was a progressive position and there was the centrist position. In every single case down the line, she took the centrist position. So the legislation, for example, to convert certain felony offenses to misdemeanors, she opposed that. Legislation brought by the Black Legislative Caucus that would have required the Attorney General's office when she was running it to investigate officer-involved shootings so that it would be more fair, she was opposed to that. Legislation requiring body-worn cameras to be worn, she was opposed to that. The legalization of marijuana, opposed to that. DNA testing for a death row inmate who many people believe is wrongfully convicted, opposed. And you can just kind of go down the list. And for me, actually, the most risible part of her record was her record on wrongful convictions. And that's what drove me to write about it. But to answer the listener's question, on those kinds of propositions, which are meant to reduce mass incarceration and be more fair, particularly to people of color who are disproportionately impacted, she was on the wrong side.
It feels like the content of your op-ed might have been used in the Democratic debates. I mean, watching Tulsi Gabbard sort of pointedly ask or pointedly put this to Kamala Harris during the debates, did you feel that that you had kind of shed a light on something that people didn't realize? Or
I had this really surreal moment when she did that, and it reminded me of when I was clerking for my judge, and we would write questions for him to ask during oral argument, and he would open his mouth and ask my question. And I had that feeling watching the debate. It was really surreal. And I thought that Harris's response was fairly disappointing, which was essentially not to address the question, not to address her record, and to fall back on platitudes. And that's generally what's happened, and it's been disappointing to me.
I want to get back to that. But this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're talking with Lara Bazelon, author of the book Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. She's also a professor and runs a clinic at University of San Francisco Law School. We'd love to hear your questions or your comments about her work. Do you have any thoughts about wrongful conviction, any experience yourself that you'd like to share? How do you feel about Kamala Harris and the presidential race? And how do you feel about what's happening in our criminal justice system? Join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website, our Facebook page, or on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. So with Kamala Harris, she was not the progressive attorney general that you thought. There's a DA's race going on right now in San Francisco. Do you have any thoughts about the candidates there?
I do. It's a really exciting race, and I would just urge your listeners to pay close attention to it. I just want to start by kind of big picture, which is we generally get really concerned about, for example, the attorney general, William Barr, or when it was Jeff Sessions. And we should rightly be concerned about what's happening very high up in the federal government. But we should be equally concerned with what's happening locally. And we have an ability to impact that because we elect our local DA. So in this race, which is in November of this year, we are electing a DA for San Francisco in a race that has no incumbent. And it's the first time that's happened in 110 years. There are four candidates running. And only one of them is someone who has never prosecuted anybody. And in my opinion, is the progressive candidate in the race. He is a public defender. And then on the other candidates are a former prosecutor who's now the counsel to the sheriff. Her name is Susie Loftus. There is a candidate who's an assistant attorney general, and there's a candidate who's currently a prosecutor in Alameda County. The public defender, Cheza Boudin, is quite unique, I think, and is running on a platform that's pretty similar to the progressive prosecutor platforms that we've seen in Philadelphia with Larry Krasner, in Chicago with Kim Fox, more recently in Queens with Tiffany Caban and Wesley Bell, Kim Gardner. So we've seen folks, Rachel Rollins, running on these platforms of, we don't believe in mass incarceration. We do believe in restorative justice. Restorative justice is part of all of these candidates' platforms. We don't believe in the death penalty. We believe in alternatives to incarceration, treatment courts. So I think when you look at candidates' platforms, it's really important to look at the platform, not just the label, and Kamala Harris sort of being the ultimate example of, oh, hey, I was really progressive. But you have to match, I think, the rhetoric with the record and what they've actually done with their lives and also what they say they're going to do once they get in office.
Do you think that restorative justice takes the place of criminal justice, or is it a supplement, an addendum to the work of finding somebody who perpetrated a crime, determining if they're guilty or innocent, and then offering, you know, whatever punishment it is? I mean, our system, as you point out in your book, is very different from restorative justice and the questions that it asks and who it's trying to serve and heal. So does restorative justice have a place to replace criminal justice, or is it an addition or an add-on?
That is a great question. And you're right that our current system is so deeply antagonistic to restorative justice principles. I do think, for example, Cheza Boudin's platform for DA is an interesting approach, where what he's saying is, I will offer restorative justice to any victim of any crime who wants it. Because the thing about restorative justice is you cannot foist it on a victim. It's victim-centered. You can't say to a victim, I'm taking away your choices. Right now, victims have one choice. They can report to the police, have the case essentially taken out of their hands by a prosecutor, have the conviction or not, be forced to testify and be cross-examined if there's a trial, or be kept out of it if there's a plea, make a statement at sentencing, and then there's a punishment imposed, and that's the end. So they should still have that option if they want it, but many victims come away from that process feeling very traumatized, unsatisfied, and unhealed. And so I think what we should be doing instead is saying, you can still have that option if that's what you want. Here is another option that is designed to really reckon with what has happened to you and heal your pain and address your anguish and acknowledge and validate your suffering and offer you a chance to address the person who hurt you and say what you need to say and hear from that person and hold that person directly accountable. And it's interesting because I think a lot of prosecutors in Law and Order, kind of tough on crime types, look at something like restorative justice, and I think Attorney General Barr has spoken very disparagingly about this kind of thing and say, well, it's really anti-victim and it's really soft on crime and it's a bunch of kumbaya handholding. And it really isn't. I've studied these programs, and when you talk to the people who've been through them, particularly the offenders, they'll tell you that what they had to do was worse than prison because they have to face the person that they hurt and listen to that person, reckon with what they did, grapple with who they are, gain a lot of insight into what caused them to be the way that they are. And many people who victimize people are victims themselves, deal with their own trauma, and then hold themselves accountable. And that's incredibly hard to do. Prison actually doesn't demand that you do that. Prison demands that you do time.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have any statistics on whether restorative justice reduces recidivism?
So that is an open question, in part because we just don't have very many of these programs. But there's a really excellent program that's been in place for over 10 years called Common Justice. And it's run by a woman named Danielle Sered in Brooklyn. And her outcomes are very good. So she works in cooperation with the Kings County District Attorney. And she's referred cases, serious violent felony cases where people are maimed, shot, stabbed. And they opt into the program. The offender opts into the program. These are serious felony charges. And upon the completion of the program, the felony charges are dismissed. And there hasn't been a high incidence of reoffending. And there's been tremendous success in terms of people completing the program and also with both participants feeling like they benefited from the program.
It really requires there was a quote in your book saying, in order for restorative justice to work, you have to have the right person, the right offender, and the right victim at the right time to make that work. And it seems like that's a program working towards that.
That's exactly right. It's not for everyone. So I guess saying we're going to replace the entire criminal justice system and force you to do something that you don't want to do when you've already had so much power and agency taken away from you seems profoundly wrong to me.
Do you feel that victim impact statements at the time of sentencing might be a form of restorative justice?
That's an interesting question. I think that they serve a purpose in that they allow the victim to speak directly to the judge, directly to the prosecutor, directly to the person who harmed them. And I feel like for some victims, that is an important thing to do. And it's interesting to think about victim impact statements on both sides because there are victim impact statements like the one, for example, in Brock Turner's case that went viral where the victim of the sexual assault talked about the trauma and her outrage. And then there are also the victim impact statements in death penalty cases where you have victims' family members begging the court to spare the person's life. Mm. So they come both ways. I don't know that they're restorative, though, because there's no dialogue. There's no reciprocity. And so you say what you have to say almost into a void, and then you finish and the judge moves on to the next thing. And I don't think that that is satisfying and healing in the same way that actually sitting in a room with someone supported by friends, them having their own people there and mediated obviously by professionals gives a victim.
Right. And we're here on City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, our guest is Lara Bazelon, the author of the book Rectify and a professor of law at University of San Francisco. We invite you to call in with your questions about wrongful conviction, criminal justice, the presidential or the DA's race. Give us a call. Join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255, or you can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on our website, or on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. I wanted to ask you about, going back to the restorative justice piece that we were talking about, you have write very beautifully about moments where the victim who is wrongfully identified a person, an innocent person going to jail for decades, coming together and where, in the case of one of the stories, Thomas Hainsworth, forgiving this woman who very believed that he was the person who had raped her, and her identification was had no bad intent, and it was truthfully that she really believed that this was the man, and he forgave her for that. Can you talk a little bit about those stories? And I'm curious how they've affected you as a person, seeing somebody who has been in prison for so many years, including your client cash register, when you see them offer that moment of grace and forgiveness to a person who has accused them of a crime they didn't commit.
It is truly profound, and it's also very humbling. And I say that as someone who spent most of my career in an adversarial setting, pitted against the other side, and really because I was a public defender, seeing victims as either people that I tried not to think about because it was too upsetting and distracting, or people that I had to incorporate into my case and explain away. And to see victims and talk to victims and spend so much time with victims, which I did to write this book, and walk through that process with them of how they realized in some of these cases, as you say, that they made this terrible mistake, and then wanting forgiveness, and then looking on the other side to people like my client, who, despite having to undergo such terrible suffering, completely unfathomable and unfair, were able to meet that grief and shame and need of the victim and say, I forgive you, knowing that they were giving that person a sense of solace, but also I think that they were helping themselves move forward as well. And it really gave me a lot of insight into how so often we hold on to rage and pain, and the people who have harmed us, whether they did so intentionally or not, exert tremendous power and control over our lives and continue to warp them after the harm has been done. And it was this lesson in forgiveness and in really reconceptualizing some of our most fundamental relationships.
Has it changed how you think about forgiveness?
It absolutely has. It made me evaluate so many different relationships in my own life and realize that by holding on to a lot of my grievances, I was preventing myself from moving forward, and more sort of profoundly that to some degree in our most fundamental relationships, we're all victims and we're all perpetrators. And the sooner that we realize that and grapple with that and understand that there is someone else on the other side with their own story, the better off we'll be.
I think that's pretty profound. And that's a great part of your book in talking about the afterlife of exonerations, because I think sometimes we think, oh, well, it's horrible that you were imprisoned. Now you're free. Your life should be an open road. This should be all, you know, rainbows and unicorns now. And sometimes the individual gets compensation. Sometimes they don't. But at least they're free. But that isn't the case, is it?
No, we love the Hollywood ending. We really love that. And we think that there's going to be this screenshot of the person riding off into the sunset, or as you say, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And that's not how real life works. It's not how it works at all. And so when someone is exonerated, I describe it, equate it to an earthquake, because it's shattering for them to return to society. It's shattering for the victims to have their sense of peace and justice profoundly and permanently altered. It's shattering for the exoneree's family to reintegrate this person into their life. And then, as you say, there's this question of the suffering Olympics, who gets compensated and who doesn't. And it's this crazy patchwork of laws where it's really up to the state that you're in, if you are able to get money or not from the state, or whether you're going to have to sue and whether that lawsuit would be successful. You have exonerees like my client who got, I think, close to $19 million, every dime of which I will say he deserved. And then you have other people who have suffered also horribly who get nothing.
Wow. I have another question from a listener. Emily from San Francisco writes, what should the criminal justice system do about repeat offender rapists? What do we do with them?
That's a really good question. And that's actually sort of, I think, the next frontier for restorative justice. I described this program in Brooklyn, Common Justice, and they do not include people who have been charged with any sex crimes, even though they include extremely violent offenders, including people who have almost killed other people and maimed them. And there's a shying away from applying restorative justice in cases of sex crimes. And I've been thinking a lot about this recently in the case of these sexual assaults, that often the victims don't see justice. This is a shocking statistic, but people do sexually assault repeatedly other people, and yet the conviction rate in this country is less than 1%. Less than 1% of reported rapes and sexual assaults end in a conviction. So there's a lot to unpack there, but there's a real false promise, which is a prosecutor saying to a victim, I will absolve your pain by holding your rapist to account in the most severe way I possibly can. And it's a false promise for two reasons. One, it's highly statistically unlikely to happen. And two, these very long sentences don't actually bring any healing to the victim or necessarily any insight on behalf of the offender. And so the real question is, what should the alternative be, given that what we have right now is such a colossal failure? There have been efforts since the 1970s to make things more fair and less horrible for victims in the prosecution of a rape case, but that hasn't increased reporting and it hasn't increased success in terms of obtaining convictions. There is some evidence, these pilot programs, very few of them, to suggest that it may be that restorative justice is an alternative. I do think, though, it's highly, highly complicated when you're talking about a case of someone who is violent and a repeated offender, because that suggests a degree of danger that it may be that restorative justice is not designed to address. On the other hand, it may be that restorative justice is designed to address so many of these assaults, 78% of which the victim and offender are known to each other, over 30% involve intimate partner violence. And you can see how the application of these principles might actually be beneficial to the harmed parties where the traditional carceral solution is not.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk a lot about many of the stories in your book are about women who've been raped and wrongfully identified the rapist. And this is a little bit of a tangent, but you also wrote recently about the Christine Blasey Ford hearings with Justice Kavanaugh and this idea of misidentification and how a lot of people were saying, well, she believes what she's saying, but maybe she's misidentified him, and so they both can be right. You know, she's telling her own truth, and he's telling his truth because he's been misidentified. Why is that wrong?
I felt pretty outraged by that explanation, and it was put forward by a lot of Republican senators who were clearly grasping at anything they could to vote for him, including Susan Collins. And basically what they were saying is what you said. Well, it's just a case of mistaken identity, and that fundamentally misunderstands what misidentification is. It is in a stranger context. It's stranger sexual assaults and stranger rapes. Often cross-racial. That's what the statistics overwhelmingly show us. This is a woman who was saying, I knew this person. I've known this person. He was familiar to me. I'd seen him over and over. I went to this party and he did this very violent, sexually assaultive thing to me. You're very unlikely to be mistaken when you know who it is.
So it's a difference between acquaintance slash date rape versus stranger rape, that misidentification doesn't work the same in both of those contexts.
That's true. And it's also true that these are two people of the same race who were well known to each other. Yes.
Right. I have another question or comment from Rua from San Francisco writes, doesn't Kamala, as a groundbreaking woman, need to be careful and conservative? My grandmother always said, don't scare the horses. Doesn't Kamala need to be mindful of that?
It's a really good point, and this is what's so hard about criticizing her, because she is a pathbreaker. She was the first Black elected district attorney in San Francisco, the first Black elected female attorney general in the state of California. She's broken so many barriers, and it's hard to imagine that she could break the barriers that she's broken if she had taken very progressive positions along the way, that there were times when probably she had to shift more toward the center, and in part that was to, for example, gain the support of police and law enforcement, which can be critical to winning. So an example is when she first ran for attorney general, she won by less than 1% of the vote. She squeaked into office, and she didn't have the support of law enforcement groups. And then during her tenure, she became increasingly conservative. And when she ran for reelection, she had their support and she won in a landslide. So I guess the question is, well, what are the trade-offs to success? And I do say in my piece that we expect politicians to have to barter and trade to ultimately get other things that are important to them. But when I look at her record, I feel like she gave everything away. And that, to me, makes her different than someone who's making some political calculations, but also at times taking progressive positions. But truly what motivated me to write it was that I felt that she was really misbranding herself, that she was seizing upon this label and saying, this is me, I'm progressive, when in fact that was not true. And worse, that she had a very troubling record of keeping innocent people locked up in prison.
So it was just, if she hadn't called herself progressive and just said, I'm a centrist on criminal justice, that would have been okay.
I think if she had just leveled with all of us and said, I made the decisions that I made for pragmatic reasons, which of course no politician can say, right? Or if she had just been more straightforward and less, I would say, sort of challenging to people on the left. Because when you say to someone who really is on the left in the criminal justice field, I was a progressive prosecutor, we know that you weren't. Mm. And so you're almost asking, I think, to be called out. And that's what I felt was happening in her book. And I just couldn't let that lie there. I felt this real need to correct the record.
Well, let's talk about, as we're finishing up, another one of your op-ed pieces about Betsy DeVos and Title IX, and you kind of referenced it earlier in our conversation. Basically, you coming out and saying, I'm a feminist, but I am in favor of some of these Title IX reforms when it comes to sexual assault. And you got a lot of negative commentary for that. So can you describe what your position was and what kind of response you got?
Yeah, so we're coming back full circle to the beginning of our interview when you asked me about the reactions to the piece about picking my job over my kids. The reactions to the piece about Title IX included people leaving death threats on my voicemail at work. It really angered people. My point about it was, in this college campus disciplinary system, we are not using due process. And as a result, what we are doing is we're taking allegations. We are funneling them through a single investigator system where one person is playing police, detective, prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner, interviewing both sides, making a determination by the lowest possible standard, and then recommending the ultimate punishment, which is often expulsion. And in the Racial Justice Clinic, what we do is we represent students of color who are accused of sex offenses on campus and facing expulsion. And I can tell you just from that posture how Kafkaesque it is to have these accusations. You're not entitled to see any evidence. You're not entitled to ask any questions. You're not even entitled to a neutral fact finder. Fortunately, last fall, the California Court of Appeals stepped in and overturned the system that was used by the California State University system and the UC system, which is the single investigator model, and said, this is inconsistent with basic notions of due process. And that's all I was saying. And I was also saying, I believe that this has a racial slant. And you would have thought I was calling for the world to be burned down. So I was making a pretty basic point. The problem is that if you're me, you don't have very many allies because it's considered sort of apologizing for rape or being an anti-feminist. And then unfortunately, the person who was saying we need more process was Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, about whom I agree with almost nothing. I'm a Democrat. I don't condone or sanction. I'm horrified every day by what is happening in our current presidential administration. They did, however, say these processes are defective and don't comply with due process. And that is the case, which is what I was pointing out.
Well, I have two questions about that. One is, why are these acquaintance rapes or date rape cases being handled within the context of the university versus taken to the police? Well, can you answer that one?
So there are two reasons. One is that Title IX, which is the statute that prohibits discrimination based on gender, has been held by courts to apply to campuses. And so if you don't address these issues, you are engaging in Title IX discrimination. So they're legally required to do it now. The other reason is that a lot of these cases don't get to the police because the victims don't or the accusers don't want to report, or they do report and the police say there just isn't enough here to even refer this for prosecution. There's no way we could prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And so the only justice the accuser is going to get is going to be through a disciplinary system.
And that kind of goes into your point about how few rapes result in actual conviction, right? Whether that's a criminal justice system or whether it's on campus.
That is true. And it's also really troubling to look at the data because what it shows is that people, women of color, trans women, and women who are part of the LGBTQ community are much more likely to be sexually assaulted, and they're much less likely to report. And part of that is because they believe, and the studies show, that they will be treated dismissively and disrespected by the police, and that they're less likely to be believed, and that because they aren't white, their pain is discounted. Statistically speaking, we actually believe that their pain is less awful and less traumatic. So there's all kinds of reasons for not wanting to report.
In a little bit of time we have left, and we're having this DA race in the fall and, you know, a presidential race in 2020, what would you like to see on a local and a national level in terms of criminal justice reform? What are some things that we should take care of that are urgent?
I think that we urgently need to address not just wrongful convictions, but terribly excessive sentences. So I actually think it's not enough to have a conviction review unit and say, we're all about innocent people. I think you need to have a unit that says, I gave this person 75 to life when they were 19 years old. I need to revisit that decision. This idea that someone can commit one crime or two crimes and basically have their entire life thrown away, us pay for it, is to me, just an abysmal failure and an expensive, crazy way to say that you're doing justice because you're just ravaging communities, racking up costs, and getting no benefit out of it. And I feel like this mass incarceration situation that we have, we can't just move forward proactively. We have to look back at what we've done and try to fix it.
Right. And I'm going to take one last email from a listener, Tria. She writes, I voted in favor of Prop 74, but now find the quality of life severely impacted in San Francisco. The complete lack of consequences for property crimes has led to a feeling of lawlessness, where on a daily basis, I and my small children witness car break-ins and thefts. Even though people are not necessarily hurt in those situations, the effect is a loss of feeling of sanctuary and safety here. What do you think about this issue and what can be done?
It's a really good point, and I think a big issue in this DA race is going to be exactly what your listener was talking about, and in particular, these car break-ins, which are astronomically high and really under-prosecuted, which is interesting because you would think a lot of it is caught on surveillance because we have cameras everywhere, but these crimes really aren't prosecuted. So the problem is when you take a series of crimes and there's no remedy whatsoever, the person isn't caught or held to account in any sort of way, carcinogenic, restorative, or otherwise, then society is left to feel unsafe that this could happen to them. It could happen to their friend. It happened last week. Ask anybody you know and they will tell you someone who has been the victim of a car burglary. It's one of those crimes that touches everyone. And it's a real issue because I think that there's a sense that nothing has really been done to address it under the current administration.
So do you think that it's going to require a repeal of Prop 47 or what needs to happen?
No, I don't think that needs to happen. What I do think needs to happen is that there needs to be more detective work done. I think that people who commit these crimes need to be found. Whether they're candidates for something like restorative justice or not, I leave up to the people whose cars have been broken into. I imagine there are many people who might find a dialogue like that to be somewhat fruitful and effective, or they might choose to have the person be held to account. But I think the problem right now is that you have people who are so deeply addicted and desperate for money that they're just smashing cars and taking wallets and taking computers because that's the easiest way to get the money that they need to feed their addiction. And they know they won't get caught. So a couple of things have to happen. They need to get caught, and their underlying issues need to be addressed one way or another.
And do you feel like addressing homelessness is something that the DA needs to take care of?
I don't think we can dump every societal problem on the DA. And I think, unfortunately, what's happened is that our jails have become these basically mental health hospitals. So many people in jail are mentally ill. And it's just become a way of warehousing people now that we don't have hospitals for people who are mentally ill and we have nowhere else to put them. Same with people who are homeless. And I don't think you can just turn to the DA and say, now it's all your problem. I think we need to come up with alternatives, community-based alternatives. We need to put more money into treatment and into hospitals and into directly serving the needs of people who are committing low-level offenses because they're just desperate and poor.
All right. There you have it. And now if there's a listener out there who wants to get in touch with you to get help from your clinics at USF, is there a link that they could go to?
You just go to the USF School of Law website, and then there is a link to the clinical programs, and then there's a link under that to our clinics, and you can find us there very easily.
And your clinics focus on what exactly?
So the Racial Justice Clinic does a variety of things. Over time, we've helped with death penalty cases. We're working on this wrongful conviction case. We do Title IX disciplinary cases. And in the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Clinic, we represent people who are charged with misdemeanors in San Francisco Superior Court, and we get those referrals from the DA. We also represent people in San Quentin who are trying to get out under youthful offender parole statutes, and we help people get their property back.
Oh, great. Well, we'll put that resource up on our website. And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guest tonight was Lara Bazelon, professor of law and the director of the Criminal Juvenile Justice and Racial Justice Clinical Programs at University of San Francisco of Law. She's the author of the book Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction, and is a frequent contributor to Slate, The New York Times, Politico, and The Atlantic Monthly. Thank you for joining us this evening, Lara.
Thank you so much for having me.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Next week we'll be off, but join us in 2 weeks, right after Labor Day. This is Grace Swan. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.